previously on Popping Collars.
Gosh, Baltimore. That's like the perfect city to set the show. Charm city, man. That's what we're trying to strive for, I think. It's like this idea of we are imperfect, but damn it, we're charming.
<You know? laughs> Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture, the show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, and I am your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests, who this week include not one, but two priests from Omaha, Nebraska. First, we have Liz Easton. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Really good. And also with us, Craig Loya, joining us for the first time. Welcome, Craig.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Liz.
We're taking over the Diocese of Nebraska on Popping Collars.
The Diocese of Nebraska is taking over Popping Collars. That's the other way around.
This is episode 19 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is Mad Men, set in the 60s and a little of the early 70s. Mad Men is the story of an advertising firm and the various characters that work there, most notably a dapper gentleman by the name of Don Draper. Now, Don is a lot of things. He's an excellent salesman. He's a not-so-great family man. He's a womanizer. And probably most importantly, he's a fraud, a man with multiple identities. But Don's not on an island here. There are certainly no shortage of strange, inspiring, frustrating, lovely, and loathsome people that populate this world. So let's just jump right into it. Who was your favorite character on the show, and why?
I'm going to start just so that I can put dibs on Peggy Olson.
All right.
She was my favorite, and I know that I'm not alone. I think a lot of people have wondered if all of Mad Men was really about Peggy and sort of her development as a character and what she represents in not just women's history, but sort of American history during that time period. But I loved her because you got to see her grow, I think, a lot and grow in a direction that I found appealing. And my favorite genre or subgenre of television and movies is anything about people who do their job well. Like I Dead Poets Society will make me cry because it's about a guy doing his job well, and that's the stuff that I like. Which is
Walter White, Breaking Bad. Yeah,
yeah, like math, Walter. You. I love the stuff like that, which probably says a lot about me. But what I liked about Peggy is she was sort of embracing all of the opportunities that were in front of her and taking risks and going places where, you know, people hadn't really gone before. She was a trailblazer and also really vulnerable. And I like that she was struggling with a real issue that women and men, but women today are still struggling with, which is how to have a career that is exciting and edifying and, you know, great for you while also balancing that with, you know, what you want for your personal life. And that was always hard for Peggy. So I was always rooting for her as a professional woman because I too am a professional woman.
It's interesting to see what she turns down in order to get to where she gets to by the end of the show.
Yeah, and she made some bad decisions too, but I feel like she always had a lot of integrity, kind of more than some other characters.
And there was something about Peggy, you know, that she was the character that I think I think everybody who was a fan of the show was always rooting for. You know, she, a lot of the hard things that happened to her were not of her own doing, and she was really dealt a bad hand in lots of ways. And I think part of the reason, even though there was a little bit of romantic comedy aspect to her ending with Stan, part of the reason that was so satisfying is that I felt like for seven seasons, I had just been rooting for something really good to happen to Peggy, you know. So the last couple of episodes of her character were particularly satisfying in that way. The most interesting character to me was Sally Draper. And I think she was the most interesting character to me because she really grows and matures, I think, emotionally more than anybody else in the entire series does. And it was really fascinating to watch Sally just watch everything that was crumbling around her, this really difficult family life. You know, her childhood was not exactly as grim as Dawn's, but it wasn't too far off, right? It was a pretty traumatic childhood. And by the end of it, the last couple of episodes, especially when she was away at boarding school and the phone conversations she would have with Dawn, you know, she was so much the adult in that family at that point. The way she handled Betty's diagnosis, the way she handled the last couple of conversations with Dawn, it was just really interesting to see her watch the disaster that their lives and their marriage was. And then really by the end, you could see a way that she had found that she was going to put this back together and do something with this and move forward from this. And I thought that was, she was a pretty interesting and complicated character. I think the most entertaining character for me in a lot of ways was Roger. And he was entertaining for he was not a good person, really. He's not a good person. One of the reasons he was so entertaining is that Roger was really in this position. He was old enough when the series started that he had already reached a position of wealth and privilege that was completely cemented, right? So whereas Dawn and Betty were pretty neurotic in lots of ways about this major social transformation that was happening, you know, Roger's attitude toward the whole thing was he was just kind of bemused by it, you know, and so he just kind of went on doing his thing and experimented with drugs and, you know, did all this goofy stuff. But he didn't really need to be threatened by the social change because his position of power and privilege and wealth was already well cemented by the time period that the show started.
But what Roger was affected by and remained affected by through the whole series was his experience in the war.
Mm-hmm.
Like that always came up. And I think that he freaked out a few times, like when they were going to work with Honda or mm-hmm. something. And, you know, he kind of went crazy talking about the war. And even in that last, like, really beautiful scene that he shared with Peggy, he was reflecting on his experience in the Navy. And I think that was a thing. Like, I think that my parents' generation is still profoundly affected by Vietnam, even mm-hmm. if they didn't serve in it. And their parents' generation was profoundly affected by World War II. So I think that was pretty intentional. Like this guy who's kind of a goofball and doesn't seem to care about much is carrying around in him this really mm-hmm. unsettling experience that he had.
After I watched the finale, I went back and I watched the very first episode in the series. And there's this great moment at the end of the very first episode where Dawn and Betty have been out with Roger and his wife, and they get home and Betty goes to the kitchen sink and she puts on those yellow rubber gloves. Mm-hmm. And Dawn says to her, he kind of snaps at her. He says, just leave that for the girl, which presumably he means their housekeeper. And then in the last scene with Sally, you know, she has on those yellow rubber gloves and Betty's sitting at the table smoking and like Sally's doing the dishes, which I think generationally, that's exactly kind of the point of the series, right? Is that Dawn and Betty have kind of had their thing. They're just in this sort of free fall. And Betty and her generation kind of have to like, they have to do the dishes. They have to like figure out how we're going to make sense of all of this mess, you know?
I've heard it said also that this show is really Matthew Weiner attempting to figure out how we got the world that we have now. Mm-hmm. It's like, how did we inherit the corporations that we have, the sort of structure that we have of, you know, money will get you this kind of power, that kind of power. It won't get you this, but it will get you this thing over here. And so it's this kind of deconstruction of like, well, where does this come? Where were we sold the world that we have now? And we were sold it by these guys on Madison Avenue mm-hmm. in the 60s, kind of, you know, that pointed us on this trajectory to here.
I, from like very early on, like the first season, I kept thinking that it would be great if they did a spinoff series based on Sally and Bobby. And it occurred to me, like when I was sitting here thinking about it, that like maybe that show was 30-something. Yeah. Maybe they did that, and that show is called 30-something.
I thought the same thing. As right after the finale, I was thinking that it would be great to see a show about Sally Draper in, like, the mid-80s, you know, married to the Michael Douglas character from Wall Street or something like that.
Yeah, shoulder pads.
Exactly. Right. Where I come at Don Draper is through Dick Whitman. And it strikes me that really what rests at the core of Dick Whitman is fear. He's just a big coward. And so, you know, Don Draper being sort of the most charismatic person in the room, it helps to know that somewhere deep down, buried through all of those layers that make up who Don is this sort of scared kind of individual. And I saw a lot of those, like everything looked awkward to him at the end when he was trying to connect to another human being. Like that hug was very awkward. Him calling up Betty was very awkward. Like all of these exchanges are just so awkward. And I think that it ultimately comes back to, you know, just this bundle of fear that sort of rests at the center of it. He can't authentically love somebody because he doesn't even love himself, really. He spent his entire life denying who he really is.
That really opens up part of the what I think is the real Christian theme of it. It's not really a theme, but some Christian ideas in that the show raises. You know, in the very first episode, Don tells Rachel Menken, when he's talking to Rachel Menken, he says, she's talking about being in love, and he says that you know, love is what you call love is something that people like me made up to sell nylons. And I think that in some ways, Don is exactly right. You know, so at the end of the finale, there's this sense that whether Don wrote the Coke ad or not, the whole legacy of that era is that identity is now a commodity that you can purchase and that you can exchange, and reconciliation and peace are really just about, you know, drinking sugar water or whatever. And I think that's contrasted with the Christian understanding of love, where an authentic experience of love is about limiting your choices, right? And what you can commodify and exchange. And love requires sacrifice on the one hand and vulnerability on the other hand, the two things that sort of marketing engine allow you to avoid anytime you want to avoid them, you know? And I think at the end of the day, that's what's cynical about the ending, is that Don has just accepted, as much as he's been desperate in his life to be loved and to love somebody else, he's not willing to pay that cost of sacrifice and vulnerability.
Yeah. And he doesn't really know how, you know,
right.
No, he has no tools at all.
It's important that the show is set in the 60s, because we're so far removed from the 60s now that it's not nostalgic for us kind of watching it. It's our parents and maybe our grandparents' lives that we're kind of watching. You know, you see things like the smoking in the office, the drinking in the office, the shaking out their picnic blanket and shaking the litter all over the grass. And you think to yourself, oh, it's like watching cavemen. You know, it's like we are so more sophisticated in this day and age. We have so much more knowledge than these. I think that that's really the sin of sort of pride and arrogance of the younger generation, kind of looking back at older generations and thinking that they're not nuanced and they're not sophisticated and that they're not living their lives in an authentic way because the trappings around them seem so antiquated to our eyes.
Well, I think that's why it's so interesting that the counterculture is kept on the fringe. And what I think would make this show pretty depressing and cynical for people who participated in that counterculture is that you see that powerful movement that was meant to, like, destroy all of the, you know, the oppressive structures of our society actually maybe didn't work. And I mean, the countercultural movement of the 1960s produced the 1980s. You know, this totally radical time period ended up creating the most hedonistic period in American culture. And I would imagine that that's incredibly sad and devastating for the people who really truly felt at that time, like, we are changing the world. And I sort of think that that is what the show is about a little bit. It's like, you didn't.
The great thing about it, both the thing that's great about it as a show, but the thing that makes it hard, I think, to focus in on particular themes is pretty much anything that has to do with human relationships or social and cultural change is, I think, at least touched on in the show. You know, one of the things that I think is one of the only major themes from the last half of the 20th century that the show doesn't pay hardly any attention to is race, which I think is a pretty glaring omission. I mean, there's a few episodes that sort of glance off of race, but it doesn't get explored a whole lot. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about that I would be interested to know how you saw this, Liz, is the extent to which any of the characters really change over the trajectory of the show. I mean, my sense of it is that from the beginning, I think the women on the show are a lot more interestingly and complexly drawn than the men are. I mean, most of the men, I think, stay pretty static, really, through the whole series. And I think the major female characters actually change pretty significantly. You know, but I don't know. I mean, I've also read a couple of things where people didn't really like where the Peggy and Joan characters end up, you know? So I'd be interested. To me, I think Joan and Peggy probably go through the biggest transformations of any other character on the show. Whereas I think people like Roger and Don and even, you know, Pete, they're basically the same people at the end of the show as they were at the very beginning.
Right. I think that is a theological concept for sure. Like the identity and who we're created to be and, you know, freedom and denial and obedience and all of that stuff is wrapped up in there.
Yeah. I mean, I think in the first episode, Dawn, you know, and it's also interesting to bookend what they're trying to sell in the first episode is cigarettes, which kill you. And they're trying to sell them in a way that convinces people they're not really going to kill them. And, you know, what they're selling at the very end of the finale is Coke, you know, which is also like really unhealthy. And, you know, that's just interesting that bookend. But in the first episode, Dawn tells Rachel Menken that advertising is about happiness. And happiness is about fundamentally being reassured that you're okay. And I think that from a theological perspective, knowing that you're okay is not actually about, you know, smoking cigarettes and pretending like they're not going to kill you. It's not about choosing whatever new identity or new partner or whatever else that you want to choose at any point. Knowing that you're okay is actually confronting the depths of how broken that you are. And knowing that God sees you and God loves you anyway. And that's really what at least Dawn is either unwilling or incapable of doing through the whole series, is being able to accept that he's okay in the depths of his brokenness, not because he's able to brilliantly reinvent himself all the time.
Well, he's constantly trying to protect himself from those broken places, I would say. I mean, like the duality of his work world and his family world, I think are that's where you really see the real Don Draper. His true happiness is in his work and his ability to sell. And it's actually being with the people that he's supposed to love, that he's supposed to want to be with, that he's at his most miserable.
It's interesting to me that, you know, when Peggy has the baby and Don visits her in the hospital, which in itself is kind of an astonishing thing for him to do, and says to her, you'll put this behind you, you'll be amazed how much this never happens. Then you fast forward many years later when she's sitting with Stan and is finally able to tell him about what happened and confront her brokenness there. That's when she is then very quickly able to accept herself and receive love from him. Mm-hmm. So the Don Draper paradigm is broken right in that it was, maybe it was good advice that he gave her in the moment. It certainly allowed her to get on with her life and, you know, accept her decision. But it wasn't until later that she was really able to share that part of herself with another person in a really vulnerable way that she found true happiness.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what maybe is the piece of the finale that's not cynical, is that at the very end of the finale, right before Don's experience, Anna's daughter leaves the retreat center, presumably, it's never said, but presumably because she's going to go reconnect with her child. You know, that's been what she's been struggling with while they've been there. So in some ways, people like Peggy and Anna's daughter and some of the other characters are breaking that pattern that Don has been caught in, even though Don himself doesn't seem to be able to break out of it.
Yeah.
well, that's what allows Don to continue to be a compelling character, even though he's a pretty terrible person, is because, and I think not only for the audience, but for the other people in Don's life, you know, because his advertising genius depends upon this incredible wisdom about human nature and human relationships. And that wisdom that he has, that insight that he has, it's authentic and it's real, but he, like all advertising, uses it to manipulate, you know, and to uses it for his own ends rather than using it to authentically connect with other people.
Right. And in the end, you know, you called it, in the end, that's exactly what he does. And I also quickly grew tired of Don, in part because I'm naturally very like hopeful and sort of optimistic. And so dark television is never that appealing to me because I don't get it. And so with Don, every season, I legitimately thought, like, this is it. He's changing. He's, you know, he's going to be a good man now, or he's going to be happy and he's going to love truly. And I really, truly thought it was going to happen, and it didn't. And there's something to learn from that type of experience, you know, about myself and just about people in general, that, you know, sometimes people are what they are. you have to choose when to invest and when not to invest. And everybody around Don would have known that about him. Mm-hmm. Really. You know, he really wasn't fooling anybody at the end of the day. He was a mess. He was a train wreck and everybody knew it. Mm-hmm. But he was handsome. And so he got away with a lot.
Struck me when we were talking about generations. So when I was a teenager, I was in a Presbyterian church, grew up Presbyterian. We were growing. It was a really great thing. Like, the ministry was growing. We were outgrowing our space, and so we were having to create multiple services and all this other stuff. And the conversation came up, as you know, as it probably does in a lot of places where things are going really well, of, well, do we need a new space, right? Do we need to sort of build a new church or find a larger church or something like that? And ultimately, that's what the church leadership decided to do. They decided to build another church. And that was when I was kind of introduced to this idea of being on the ground floor of something and seeing the beginning of something and seeing the hard work that people put into building something. You know, like the generation that built the church that we're talking about selling as if it's no big thing. Like, it was everything to them. It was everything. Every single brick meant something to this generation. And I think their concern was that it felt like it was just being cast away, you know, it was just being sold. Like, it was meaningless. Like, it didn't, like, there was nothing of value there. And that's the same kind of language that I hear whenever, like, changes to the prayer book come up. And I think that there is this kind of disconnect, this gap that exists between generations. And it all comes down to love, and love of these things that we create and these things that we build. And I think that the thing that I appreciate about Mad Men is that I would have never been able to identify the things that were lovely about that kind of 60s society of power unless the show had existed. Mm-hmm. Like, I would have always just kind of assumed, oh, that was the messy stuff that got us to this world. And yet there are actually some really lovely pieces. They're broken pieces too, but there's lovely pieces. And I think that it's important for us to hear those stories because it connects us. It bridges those gaps a little bit.
I think you're exactly right. I think one of the ways that the show guards against, that tendency for one generation to just dismiss the generation that came before as uniquely problematic in some way is on a really superficial level. I mean, this is honestly, for the first three or four episodes, why I was watching it. It's just so beautifully put together. You know, the costumes are great. The sets are great. You know, you just fall in love with spending time in this world. And what that does then is it, I think, right away connects you with characters that live in a time that feels very different from anything that I've ever known, and certainly anything that we're living with now. And then it allows you to see, in some ways, like, we're all living with Don Draper, you know, and every generation has the same challenges in terms of being able to connect with other people and build meaningful relationships and deal with whatever messes the previous generation has left. You know, every generation is in the same boat in lots of ways. It just looks different on the surface. And I think that's really one of the things that makes the show work well.
Oh, absolutely. And the thing I think for us is that churches and religious communities remain one of the only spaces in our world now where generations interact in a meaningful way and build relationships and are forced to kind of be together and love each other. So all of this stuff is kind of a live issue for us in churches and in church leadership to understand the values that are different for each generation and what rubs against those and what liberates those. And so, yeah, a show like this goes a long way to seeing how those relationships can be built and that at the end of the day, we really are all struggling with the same types of things.
Collective destruction, choose to attend the devil's luncheon. See the woman as a body with one function. I'd open to discussion or any kind of trust and roll it down to substance. But we got nothing or something. Awful disgusting. The theory's been pussing and bleeding. Only worry about the hairline receding. Deceiving the masses. The Facebook status would read. Here I am pleasing all these elite asses. Time to go too dynamic from the static. While the women walk mouths to get water. And they're leading all the sheep to the slaughter. Mother Earth is getting hotter. We forgot her. And now she's pissed and igniting her daughters. Who will lead you to a new kind of life fulfill? Help you take the path that's right, no kill. Nurture your feminine side. Love you despite who made you cry and who let you die. We forgive you with a sigh, but please do not deny all the slaves that helped you build this. All the women that gave your kids a kiss. This is it.
And now it's time for our Go In Pieces segment. This is the opportunity for us to talk about how we, how people can get in touch with us and how we can get in touch with people. So Liz, where are you? What are you doing? And how can people get in touch with you?
I'm the canon to the ordinary of the Diocese of Nebraska, and I live in Omaha. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram, both at Liz East, or you can follow the Diocese of Nebraska on Instagram at Greg's favorite Instagram handle, Diocese _of_Nebraska.
Craig, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
So I'm the dean at Trinity Cathedral in Omaha. So I also live in Omaha. People can get in touch with me on Instagram and Twitter, both at Craig Loya, CRAIGLOYA.
My name is Greg Knight. I am the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. You can find us on the web at bbts.org. You can find me on Twitter at ThatGregKnight, where I rarely tweet. however, Popping Collars is all over the place, and they tweet like crazy. Popping Collars is the Don Draper to my Greg Knight Dick Whitman. Popping, you can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Instagram, Popping Collars Podcast. You can find us on the Facebook, where you can like us or friend us. And also our website, poppingcollarspodcast.com. You can also email us if you feel so inclined to use such an antiquated form of technology at poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. Finally, you can find us, our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, whether that be SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio. We're at all of those places.
And
we are also at EpiscopalCafe.com, which is a lovely site that features our podcast every single time, and we support everything they do. And you're going to want to check out Episcopal Cafe, especially as we head towards General Convention, where you want to get all of your Gen Con. And with that, that is Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, Greg.
Enjoy Omaha. Say hi to Warren Buffett for us.
Oh.
And we'll see you next time. Keep those colors pops.